nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here. I've never been to this famous university. So what's in store for you? I'd like to give you some historical development, a brief one, the drivers which are shaping our industry or vacuum technology industry. I will talk about the four most prevalent common vacuum gauge types, just superficially more or less. I will give you an example of how we improved our product using rarefied gas dynamics. And at the end, I will talk about the latest rave in our industry, the optical pressure sensing. Okay, I guess you all know what's vacuum. You know, one definition is a pressure inside a container lower than what naturally occurs on Earth. So that would be above the peak of Mount Everest at about 320 millibar. And it spans out into interstellar space where you only have fractions of particles in a cubic meter. And so these are several orders of magnitudes, 13 orders of magnitudes more. So you cannot achieve this on Earth with one pump. You need several different type of pumps for the different pressure regimes. The same holds true for pressure gauges. 13 orders of magnitude cannot be done with one single sensor. So therefore, we have different sensors, capacitance diaphragm gauges, Pirani, and ionization gauges. So pressure, a force per area, that's one way to make order in vacuum. Another one is, of course, the particle density, how many particles are in a volume. And the free mean path is also a way to look at vacuum. Okay, early history started in 1643 when Evangelista Torricelli invented his mercury barometer. And so nothing really changed for a few centuries until basically in the later part of the 1800s, some new developments appeared with vacuum gauges. First, there was the Boudon tube. So this is this curved device flexes under pressure load and drives here the dial, which indicates your pressure. A bit later, MacLeod, he came up with his device, which improves on the accuracy of the Torricelli barometer. So made it more accurate. And in 1906, Marcello Pirani, working for Siemens Halske, they made light bulbs, and he didn't like mercury anymore because of the health issues. And so he invented this device here where you have a resistor in vacuum and another one in a bridge circuit, Wheatstone bridge circuit. And mercury keeps us busy a bit. We'll see. There was the Minamata Convention signed a few years ago, maybe whatever it is, 5 years ago, which basically outlaws mercury for almost all purposes, except maybe research and Natural Metrology Institute pressure standards, because those mercury manometers, they're still around. But basically, this banning of mercury triggered then the optical development I will get at the end of my talk. So I said for the longest time, nothing really happened. People got a little bit better at doing things, doing pumps. So first there was Otto von Guericke in Magdeburg in Germany, who basically did a fire department pump and operated it in reverse to make a vacuum pump. And, well, of course, there was no real use for vacuum at that time, so nobody spent time improving things until basically Geisler appeared and he had a mercury hand pump instead of using water from what Otto von Guericke did. Geisler used mercury. And from then on was kind of what I call the quest to the ultimate vacuum. How low can you get? And so it was a combination of better pumps. Gede was also a very fruitful inventor. So he had at least two different pump designs, rotary oil pump, but he also used mercury vapor diffusion pumps. And so they were able to get to lower pressures. At the same time, there were some developments on the gauging side. And so with better gauging, you could see where you are. And then you had better pumps. Of course, with the electrification and the light bulbs, it became an industry. So the light bulb industry was driving the vacuum industry. And of course, in academia, in the 50s, was a big push for the electron tube industry. Basically, there was by Dalbert with his ionization gauge. And so in 1977, basically, Benvenuti at CERN achieved what today is still the lowest described pressure on Earth. And nothing really has been changed since then, in part also because the vacuum gauges cannot go lower. So actually, maybe in CERN they have lower pressures, but we cannot indicate it with our instruments. So that's one problem. But for the last 30 years, 40 years, no true lower pressures have been achieved here on Earth. So, as I said, the driver in the early days where vacuum became an industry was the incandescent light industry. GE, Siemens, Philips, all those. And, you know, the Pirani sensor came about because Pirani worked for a light bulb manufacturer. But today, the driver for vacuum industry is the semiconductor industry. They have very stringent requirements, and they keep us busy with their changing and requirements. So I would call today is no longer the push for lower achievable pressures, but it's the quest for reproducibility. The driver is, as I said, the semiconductor industry. If you imagine you have a room full of the same machines of etching and deposition machines, and at the end, you want to have your computer chip or cell phone chip, and they should all work the same, irrespective if it goes this way or if the batch goes somewhere from another machine, jumping from one row to another. At the end, you expect that all those chips perform the same. Actually, they don't. That's why you have different grades of Intel processors. I mean, basically, they're the same. But, you know, something went awry in the production, so maybe some tolerance got a little bit off. And so instead of the cluster size CPU with the fastest performance, you get the cheaper variant where, you know, few areas may be defective or lower performant. And so you get the cheaper K-class and then and so on. So, but of course they strive to have all chips the same, so they don't need to separate them and classify them, the cheap ones and the good ones and so on. So that means, of course, for us that our sensors should also be perfect, that they are all the same, that they're exactly the same, that they have no tolerance and measure pressure whatsoever, which is not so easy. As you can imagine, working with some manufacturing related things, that there are tolerances, and you know, so one has tighter tolerance than one other device, so that's an issue, of course. And I'd like to demonstrate it here. So if we have take repeated measurements at the same pressures, then we get this scattered distribution. And here at the center is the true value of the pressure. So we're kind of off with our distribution. You know, if you have this scattering here as a mean, we're much closer to the true value, but we still have a lot of scattering. So that's we're here truer to the true value on average, but still kind of on an individual measurement, we're still far off. Now, if you have the same machine and you repeat a batch and then you repeat another batch, and so you have those two different distributions, you talk about repeatability. If you have a machine here in Purdue and a machine in Silicon Valley and you repeat the same process and you end up with those two different distinct distributions, then we talk about reproducibility. And since we're driven by the semiconductor industry, I mean, what's really important for them, at least, that's batch to batch is the same on a particular machine, so repeatability becomes very important. Of course, also reproducibility, because they have a fab in Israel, a fab in California, a fab in China, and doing all the same. And if you have to exchange a gauge because it has been contaminated, you want to get to the same value without retuning the process on your machine. So these are really important issues for those industries. So this is the ultimate where we want to go. So we have improved the precision, so we're much closer to the true value. We have a tight distribution, so we have also improved the trueness and the precision. So that's where we want to go. Every industry has its own preferred pressure ranges. You know, space simulation is somewhere, 10 to the minus 8 Pascal. Here I switched units. You want to be below a pressure that can damage or cause a breakdown in your microchannel plates, for example. The black ones are more the academic analytical processes. Molecular epitaxy, here you need to have a very clean and very low pressures. The red area here is more the high volume manufacturing industry, where you have the semiconductor industry spanning a large range depending on the processes. They do PVD, physical vapor deposition, chemical vapor deposition, lithography, and so on. Then we have food industry, lyophilization, that's what you do, is maybe on the higher end of the pressure world. So for a particular industry, you move basically in a particular pressure range. And over the years, people have invented many ways to measure pressure, as you can see in, many, many different physical measurement principles. In our company, we basically sell commercially those with blue borders. So that makes about six different measurement principles six different techniques, arrangement, geometries, what we do. But basically, there are just then four. I will come to that. As I said, there are so many different gauges. They also have their different pressure range where they work best. Some work best near atmosphere, like diaphragm-based sensors. Then we have some in the rough vacuum, like the Piranis, where we have a thermal conductivity. So they're here quite good, not so good near atmosphere. Then for lowest pressure, we cannot measure a force per area anymore. We have to measure it indirectly by actually measuring the density, and we do this with the ionization gauges. So, but in today's market, I would say only four different measurement techniques are prevalent. Capacitance diaphragm gauges, close to atmosphere, Pirani gauges, and then hot ionization gauges and cold ionization gauge. And for each measurement principle, there are many different companies who sell products in this market. So they have different interfaces. They have maybe a display, no display. They have different flanges. They have different accuracy. They may be optimized for a particular industry. So I'm sure you will find a gauge which performs best in your application. Okay, vacuum gauges are most often installed at some vacuum chamber. Here an example, a Mars environment simulation chamber from the Spanish Institute. So I pointed out the pressure gauges you can see. Here we have a capacitance diaphragm gauge, here we have a Pirani, and here we have an inverted magnetron gauge. And so often you use several different sensors, sensor techniques on your chamber because you want to view pumping from when you loaded it under atmosphere down to your base pressure, the lowest pressure your vacuum chamber can achieve, and the process pressure somewhere in between.
Martin, quick question. You said the last one was magnetron?
Inverted magnetron. Yeah, we'll get to it very briefly in a moment, yeah. Okay, so I go here first to the hot ionization gauge. You may be familiar with it. Basically, you have here a hot filament. The temperature on the filament is about 1,800 degrees centigrade. So this causes thermionic electron emission. So electron get off the filament and gets into a figure eight around your tube, and especially inside the anode cage. That green colored is the anode, and ionize residual gas on the way, and the ions, they move then to the ion collector and cause a current you measure, and the electrons eventually hit that grid structure, and so you measure faint currents of the order of nanoamperes. Here is an incarnation of such a hot ion gauge. Here you have the filament, you have the anode cage. This particular type is actually a combination sensor because here we also have a Pirani element and we have a capacitance diaphragm gauge. So this gauge can basically do 13 orders of magnitude, but not with one measurement principle, but we have kind of clutched three together in one package. So, and the different styles and geometries of the hot ionization gauges have different performance range. So there is the triode geometry, Biot-Albert geometry, extractor geometry, to name a few. And so depending what you want to do, you should select the proper design. And over the years, we have progressed from a glass bulb Biot-Albert. I've seen today on the tour, on one tool you still have such a glass bulb Biot-Albert. Then we had other ones, so they distinguish by the way, for example, the anode grid is made, so these are basically coiled wires. The way the filaments are mounted, so here we have kind of a V-loop of the filament, here we have a tensioned filament, so this makes the small differences. Here we have a version again with a coiled anode, and then the filaments are here also coiled and fixed. And here we have quite a spread between the different gauges in terms of accuracy. Here is accuracy, here is pressure. And so we have quite some spread which came basically from the way we manufactured the gauge, and the filament can change positions when it's heated, extends, can sag, and this causes this accuracy differences between the units. Now the newer sensors have a tensioned filament, just a straight filament with some springs to keep it tensioned even when it's hot, and so we were able to tighten the accuracy between unit to unit, so this makes a more repeatable gauge if you need to replace it. Okay, here comes the inverted magnetron. That's one variant of those cold cathode gauges. Here you have a central anode pin, which is at high voltage, about 3 kilovolts. And you have the cathode. This is basically your tube. So you apply this high electric field across. And in addition, you have a magnetic field. So this causes the electrons that are created to gyrate around. And this increases the chances that it can get a ionization done. And again, basically, we measured a feeble current between the anode and cathode. And again, this is of the order of nanoamperes or lower. Here is such an inverted magnetron cut open. So here we have the anode, cathode, and here we have, not shown here, is the magnet to the side. Here in this graphics is the magnet. So this causes basically a E cross B geometry. The electric field is radially, and the magnetic field is axially. And so this gives you an E cross B configuration. And newer textbooks no longer talk about cold cathodes, because field emission could also be cold or is cold. And so they talk about E cross B gauges, which is a more accurate description of the geometry. Those gauges have progressed over the years as well. I mean, the inverted magnetron was invented basically 60 years ago in 58. So we have the 60th anniversary of the inverted magnetron. Not only, well, your university is much older with 150 years. This technique is only 60 years old. So this is basically the first incarnation it was called Balzers, the company, when they made this HV1. And over the years, they made improvements in terms of geometry and performance. And today, these are the workhorses on the market for this type of sensors. So this is... And the development here is, this is passive gauges. So you needed to have an external controller connected with a wire to your sensor. And newer style instruments, they are active, or it's called active because the controller is basically attached to the sensor. You have the power supply and the signal acquisition and shaping is already in here. So the electronics is basically mounted with your sensor, so makes it for a more compact device. But if you're in nuclear industry or in accelerators, it's maybe not so good for you, because electronics, the ones we use, is not really rad hard, so it can go bad in a radiation environment. So there you still want to have passive sensors where you can have your electronics shielded somewhere, where no radiation or not much radiation comes to it. Okay, our latest gauge looks like that. So there are some specialties here. We have actually a dual chamber instead of just a single chamber. Here we have the magnets, here the electronics in the back. The beauty with this design is that we have a different magnetization. I told you before, most inverted magnetrons use actually an axially magnetized magnet. We use here a radially magnetized magnet. It causes the outside field to be much lower. And so we become now really semi-S2 compliant. So semi-S2 is a norm in semiconductor industry, which tells how your external magnetic field can be. And if you're in this area where it's here orange, means you need to have a warning sign attached for pacemaker, heart pacemaker wears, that they're not should not come close to the sensor, otherwise their pacemaker gets reprogrammed or put in a different mode, and that's not something you want. So, but with this new gauge, we're much below that dangerous zone, and so we don't need to carry a warning label. And the gauge can also be used now close to analytical instruments, even close to electron sources or ion sources. So we can mount this close to a mass spectrometer because the external magnetic field is low. Okay, now I get to the next gauge family. It's the capacitance diaphragm gauge, and this one measures pressure as a direct measurement, so we measure a force per area. The other gauges I just talked about measure pressure indirectly by ionization. There are also a few other ways to measure indirect, like thermal conductivity and convection, which are the Pirani and convectrons, for example, or viscosity. But now the capacitance diaphragm gauge measures pressure directly, and here you can also immediately understand why they only work closer to atmosphere, because the force becomes too feeble to deflect a membrane, because that's the way it works. So here we have a solid base, we call it in our language housing, then we have a thin membrane which can deflect under pressure, so if a pressure comes it deflects the membrane. And what we measure is the distance between an electrode here and an electrode there. And so if the membrane is flat, basically means no force is applied, so that's low vacuum, so we have large gap distance. If the distance gets smaller, that means there is a force applied, which just reduces the distance. And here is picture of our membrane. It's really thin, so it's kind of translucent, so basically almost see-through. It's so thin. It's made of alumina ceramic. That's a specialty of our sensor. Most other competing products use a metal foil. But here we use alumina because alumina is fairly corrosion resistant in the semiconductor industry. So we embed the membrane into two more solid structures, the housing, and we call this the heat shield. And then we need some feed-throughs for the capacitance readouts. And here in detail is the thin ceramic membrane. This is sandwiched together between the more stable blocks, and so the membrane is of the order of about 100 micrometer, depends a bit on the model and full scale range, and so it deflects very little, and so we measured the minute movements of this membrane. To do that, there are different electronics available. So one is, again, in a bridge configuration, an oscillator. But we use basically the last two ones, a charge balance amplifier in a sigma-delta configuration, and the most recent one use a time-to-digital converter where we measure the time it takes to decay a capacitance. I don't really go into the details of the electronics, but, you know, there are different types of electronics inside. These are the yellow blocks. What's then following in with the modern sensors is a microcontroller where you do linearization and temperature adjustment and compensation, and then comes the interface to the outside world. So if you measure analog voltages, then the digital signal goes into the digital to analog converter. Manufacturing industries, they often like now buses, like EtherCAT, for example. And so I would say the latest products basically use this avenue. More older products use this kind of electronics. And so over the years, our membrane-based gauges have developed as well. Originally, we also had Inconel metallic membranes. Then we switched to the ceramic ones, but still with analog processing and analog interfaces. The latest products, they are digital signal processing. And so even fast ones we have. And we also added heaters for the manufacturing industry to bring the membrane to a particular temperature, so to prevent condensation inside the gauge, so that nothing deposits on the membrane. And by now we have a kind of a large family of different capacitance diaphragm gauges. So we have small diameter ones, so where space is of an issue. So these are 11, 13, and 15 millimeter diameters, so which can be as a OEM product or packaged in a smaller sensor. Then unheated ones, heated ones to prevent condensation. Then a client had issues with the space available for the gauge, so we made for him a square one which fit better to his chamber. And now we have also fast measuring devices. We have one for a whole hot temperatures, because electronics can't truly withstand hot temperatures. We are back basically to a remote design where the electronics, basically the controller, is remote and you have cables to the sensor. And we have a gauge which we call the Cube, which is basically a for metrology labs for calibration purposes. Inside they look something like that. So here we have the cell which you have seen before. We have the flange where you attach it to your chamber. Then we have some protection baffle, and we'll get to this in more detail shortly. Prevents some process build-up in the sensor head. And here we have the signal processing power supplies and the heater power for the heater block. So here we can adjust or bring the temperatures to 45 degrees, 100 degrees, 160 degrees. These are sort of the standard ones, or we could in principle do anything in between. So one issue with this style of sensors is they're somewhat prone to contamination. Here we have a copper deposited in the center of our membrane. And so this causes, I think in this case, a tensile stress. And so you will notice with time that you have a drift of your sensor signal for equal stable pressure. It drifts because of the build-up of this thin film, and this thin film has this inherent thin film stress, which basically compresses or stretches out the membrane depending on the material, and we can observe this as a measurement drift. That's of course not something you want to see in your sensor, because you expect the sensor to be stable for your process and not being affected by the process. But you know, in semiconductor industry, where you do dirty things and have harsh chemicals, it not only affects the product, it also affects manufacturing equipment, the vacuum chamber walls, but it also affects the sensors. And here another picture. This is a metallic membrane from a competitor, so they have the same issues. They have a deposit here in the center. And if you think of a trampoline, if you deposit something in the center, it's where it's the most sensitive, and so it's not a good thing. So in manufacturing, you also see different contamination build-up.
So here you see repeated processes, builds up tree rings, so to speak. You have pitting corrosion, you have particles on the membrane. Here you have a fully coated dirt film on the membrane, or it even clogs your tubing. And then it measures just itself and not the process anymore. And so then your pressure independent gauge, and that's not what you want your pressure gauge to be. Okay, here we took apart one. So you see it, orange deposition in the center. We have this whitish residue in the tube. And so, you know, we got this back because the client said, well, it's not working. And then we said, well, what did you do? He said, well, we cannot tell you, you know, it's, and so we have to use basically FBI methods to find out what the client did, because they don't want to tell us, because they think they give us a secret where we could make a lot of money making wafers. So they don't tell us what they did. They just said it doesn't work. And so it's kind of a difficult situation where you have to fix a problem without truly knowing what they did. So here we use now basically FBI methods to make sense what they did. And so we try to improve the gauge for a particular process or in general. So you can do certain things with your gauge, different geometries, different operating parameters to improve on the gauge. One could also change something in the process, maybe 2 degrees temperature can make a lot of difference in terms of byproduct generation, for example. But of course, they don't want to bother with gauges. They only bother with their wafer, how they make a wafer. And that's where they focus, to make a consistent wafer. The rest just has to work. So we cannot truly fiddle with the process, because that's outside our area of control. So we just have to work in improving our gauges. And of course, what we want to do is accurately measure pressure under all circumstances. And you know, this is kind of difficult in etching and coating applications, but here we try to do. I take here an example of titanium nitride. Titanium nitride is also an important material in semiconductor industry, because it works as a diffusion barrier material, prevent metal ions to go into your semiconductor material, and it also serves as capacitor electrodes. So here we studied the process. I mean, here is the main process. Titanium tetrachloride plus ammonia gives you titanium nitride plus HCl plus M2. And then in semiconductor industry, they also have cleaning cycles because it also affects their vacuum chamber. So they dry clean it with some other nasty chemical, trifluoride. And so they produce something gaseous, which they can pump away. And every so often, once a week or whatever the process is, they wet clean it. So they open the vacuum chamber and go basically with the wipe and clean it out. But I mean, you have a clean room, you know it all. So I guess I'm teaching here to the choir. But you don't only have to worry about the proper reaction you want. You have to worry a lot about the byproducts, which are also created. So here we make this ammonium chloride. We also can make this whitish powder you have seen in the tube, this titanium dioxide, the white paint. Then we have titanium dichloride and tetrachloride. We have something here, which is this yellow color, which clogged the tube. So you have to worry about the byproducts as well. So went out to get all those reaction constants from the literature for a simulation. And here we modeled a vacuum chamber, process chamber in semiconductor industry. Here you have the shower head where the gas comes in. Here you have the wafer, the substrate. Here you have the pump outlet. And our gauge typically sits here up in the corner. And just by looking at this picture, you can see that the conditions where the gauge sits are different than above the wafer. And so the process engineer is just concerned about that, what's above here. It's not his business. And so we investigated for the different materials, and you can see they have a different probability of where it can be found. Ammonia chloride basically sits over the wafer. Here it's rather comparatively clean. While with the titanium tetrachloride, it's reduced compared to the deep red here. But here with this chemical here, we're basically in the danger zone, and over the wafer there is basically nothing. So it depends where you place your gauge in your process chamber. So it can affect it. A byproduct can be created more and play havoc with your instrument. So here we used basically this whitish deposit you have seen before, and validated our simulation. Indeed, we could reproduce the whitish titanium dioxide at the proper place. So this was caused by 10 degrees temperature difference, because we had the housing attached, the cover attached to the tubes, and so there you had more heat flowing away, and so this cooled this area down just enough that it causes titanium dichloride deposition at this place and eventually clog our gauge. So since we had now some confidence in that simulation, we went out to investigate different designs. This was the one we had at that time. Then another one where we had a helical baffle system, and we also investigated some competitors' products to see how they stand. So here we look at how fast the different chemicals reach towards the end where the membrane sits. For different chemicals and different times. It's not really surprising if lighter ones go in faster than heavier ones. So this causes then a build-up of one chemical more than another. And here shown is basically plasma shield. This is a flat baffle. This is the helical baffle. Well, one has to be careful here, the different scalings here. Turns out that the helical one seems to be better. You have, at least on a short term, less particles of this kind reaching the back. But if you have a long process, it didn't truly matter anymore. But if you have a fast cyclical one, say like in an ALD process or so, then the helical one seems to be better than the old design. We also did how it performs for a step pressure reaction, how long it takes to get to the membrane. And so it basically takes about 300, 400 microseconds to reach the end. We looked at the turbulence and so on. So here I compare the plasma shield and the helix baffle system. So basically with the helix, you're faster at the stable pressure sensing than with the plasma shield. So it's dynamically the faster system than the old one. And the old one had another issue where we saw basically shock waves going back and forth inside the tubes around the corners. And so this caused then kind of this ringing of the membrane with time. So this is not something you want to see. So with the helix, we had a smoother signal, faster, stable. And so that's why with the newer products we went with the helix. And here it shows the different methods we used, codes we used. So depending what you want, we can configure a gauge to your liking. We can make a dynamically fast one for fast processes, but then they may not so be protective against contamination. If you want more less contamination, you do more baffling, but then you get to a dynamically slower gauge. So you have to play with those trade-offs. So sometimes it's good to talk with an application engineer. He can tell you what he thinks may be better for your application or not. And of course,
Martin, and UFS is what, unified full solver? What is UFS?
Yeah, unified flow solver. It's a CFDRC. Yeah. Actually, we use them. They helped us with this investigation. So.
And CFD is just now the stoves, right? It doesn't have the Boltzmann solution.
No, I don't think so. This has been done 10 years ago or so. So maybe they have made some improvements to their code. I think at that time they were working with the UFS, and so they used it also as a test for their code. And, basically I said that depending on your baffle system arrangement, you can have fewer contamination or more or faster. So that's basically what this should say. And basically here is, the fastest one is basically the old plasma shield with the supra shield. But then with the helix, we're slightly, but it's only slightly worse. But we can add the cross supra shield, but that makes it dynamically even slower. So, but with this investigation, we changed from this product with a flat baffle system here to this design with a helical baffle system and digital readout and improved heating system. And this new product truly performs better in the process. Previously, we had quite a drift over the runs, and marked differences between the cleaning before and after cleaning effect. So they made huge differences. Now with the new product, it's much more consistent, much lower drift, and much less affected by the cleaning. So overall, this performs now much better. Okay, so I think we have, depending on your application, we can basically mix and match the best or recommend the best product from our stable of sensors. I talked just about those large ones with the 38 millimeter diameter. Maybe interesting for you are the small diameters, because you have to maybe attach something to a vial or something like that. So they're smaller, 13 millimeter free membrane diameter. And here the electronics is a bit away from the actual sensor. Thermally isolated so that it can be used also near 100 degrees centigrade. All right, so this was my excursion to the CDGs. Now I have to go through the Pirani, our fourth principle. So basically you have this in your lab. You have a heated wire about 120 degrees, depending on the model. And then you have heat losses from the wire to the walls, heat loss through the support posts, and maybe depending on the geometry, heat loss or transport by convection. And over years, our gauges have changed like that. The difference is the way we mount the filament, the length of the filament, the coiling, support structure, geometries. So this has all advantages and disadvantages. The issues here is to extend the range. Standard Piranis don't accurately go to atmosphere, so either you add a convection stage and you get a convectron as you have it on your lab equipment I've seen, or you add another sensing technique to it, make a combination sensor by adding a CDG or a piezo sensor. And if you want to go to lower pressures, you can revert to MEMS Piranis, for example. Here is the classical convection enhanced, the convectrons. So they perform better at atmospheric pressure than the standard Pirani, but you need to mount it upright, and it's larger and relatively slow. If you want to exchange the pressure limits, you can go to MEMS Piranis. They have good dynamics because they have low thermal mass, but they're sensitive to contamination because a dust particle or so can easily clog your membranes. So then you can also use, which is basically a different measurement principle than the Pirani, use measure the heat capacity by pulsing. That's out there. It's also relatively slow because you have to pulse. Then we have these radiation losses at the support structures. So here maybe MEMS helps as well. So if I compare the conventional Pirani, the convectron, you can see, you know, close to atmosphere it's better, but comparatively the other values are maybe not so favorable. MEMS Pirani can be quite good in terms of dynamics, but because it's a much more involved manufacturing, they tend to be more expensive, and also they may be susceptible to contamination, dust, for example. And the heat capacity measuring Pirani is also relatively slow. So in process can things happen like that, where you have polymerization on the filament. The filament is too hot for your organics, and so you polymerize it, and then you get this structure, and your accuracy goes away. If you have fluorine in your system, it etches your tungsten away, and eventually it's etched through and it's no longer working, or it can play havoc with your accuracy. So after I forgot exactly, this was before the test and this was after the test, so you know the accuracy has changed because the wires have been affected. They have a different diameter. They have a different thermal emissivity. And so, of course, you can also change materials. Instead of using tungsten, you can use nickel or platinum filaments, depending on the chemistry you use. And so, you know, everything essentially is application dependent. You have to select the proper materials for your processes. Here we have a zinc oxide buildup. Again, the filament wire was too hot, so we have this zinc oxide buildup, and so you have a different coils basically, or even a shortening of the coils, and so it performs poorly. And so we have also changed models. Previously we had the green one, So again, we had here some camel bumpers in the accuracy area. So we have, you know, close to 20% deviation. Now with the newer sensors, we're much closer to the true value. So that's something which you like. You know, each sensor has its own design issues. This one here is a combination sensor, Piranha, with the capacitance diaphragm gauge. Typically, the feed-throughs are an area of issue. Bonding materials. And so what we do now is we can ALD code our sensors to protect them against the process chemistry. And we have tested it again in peroxide, and it performs perfectly. No more issues, even though it's coated. Basically here. That's also something I talked earlier with Drew. I saw that he has in his lab. He's filling with wireless Pirani and Alina Shinox. Sophia Toto from the Migrate project. So she also works on wireless pressure sensing, not only wireless data acquisition, but also wireless power transmission, so that you are truly free of wires. But you know, this is commercially equipment and kind of large the antenna here. So for a serial product, we need to work then on kind of making things more compact, but this is kind of first demonstration. Okay. You know, making things more accurate, more repeatable also needs investment in manufacturing. We have increased our automation using robots and testing equipment. So we use statistical process control to keep our manufacturing processes under control. Optical inspection tools, here welding inspection, automated factory calibration. So we can then collect the data, kind of our Internet of Things. So keep in store. And now I come to the last part, is the optical methods. As I said, mercury is basically banned, and this triggered a new development together with next spring. The SI system will be redefined. So you have will have a new definition for the kilogram. It's no longer a piece of metal in Paris as your definition of a kilogram. You will have now quantum standards, so you can reproduce it everywhere on this world. So you become independent of the kilogram in Paris. And so this triggered then optical methods. Here at INFICON, it's more classical. Instead of electrical capacitance readout, we read out the gap distance now as a interferogram determined gap distance. And so we have this in our lab available. Then at NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Gaithersburg, Maryland, they invented this fixed-length optical cavity. Basically, that's also a dual-chamber interferometer. In one, you have your vacuum, and the other one, you have the gas or the gas pressure you want to measure. And the change in frequency is dependent on the refractive index. And the refractive index is also dependent on the pressure. And so you can basically determine the pressure by measuring the changes in the refractive index. And so they compare basically the gas filled one against the reference and are able to measure. Pressure very good. So this is now, they claim the size of a travel mug. It's okay, this sensing element, but they need a full table of optics with it. Yeah, and so it's not truly attachable to your chamber at this point, but they're working to make things smaller. But what's impressive, after just about 5 years of development, they are better than the old trustworthy mercury column manometer they had. And so they retired three mercury manometers so far. They are no longer in use, and replace now custom calibrations of capacitance diaphragm gauge with the new flock. So this is now already in production. So they use this system now for customer calibration. Now NIST is, was maybe the first, but not the only one these days. Other standards institutes are catching up. Here is an approach by the University of Umeå in Sweden. They call it the gas modulation refractometry. Again, it's basically a dual interferometer. They just operate it differently. They operate it at very short time scales. NIST has the approach of having everything ultra stable. So they use in their lab, they have hundreds of a Kelvin resolution of the temperature and adjustment. So they have everything ultra stable. The Swedes go basically the way measure fast, then you're not affected by the drift, or you can eventually determine the drift to eliminate it. So they go sort of a fast route. At the moment, this becomes more like a secondary standard, while the NIST system can be a primary standard if you use helium as your reference, because helium can be quantum physically determined what the refractive index should be. So from theory, you can have the exact value of the refractive index, and so everything is determined. So the NIST can do it as a primary system, but only for helium, basically. If they use a nitrogen as a reference, they cannot calculate it quantum mechanically at this point. So maybe somebody is smart enough to get through all the mathematics, and maybe one time will do. Otherwise, they are now also making comparison values so that you can use your helium one and convert it into nitrogen. All right, so here at the end, gauges are becoming better, if you believe it or not. They become more robust for industrial processes. They're less affected. But to achieve this requires a deep understanding of many different fields, physics, material sciences, chemistry, manufacturing technology. All this comes together. So it's actually a very interesting field. I mean, I didn't think at the time when I joined industry that it can be so rewarding to look at all those different things. So even though you say we only have four different measurement technologies, you have to understand many, many more things. And so it becomes really interesting and challenging and rewarding even to work in industry. So, and the latest development in vacuum industry is the optical methods. I think that goes fast. NIST is working at reducing sizes. The Swedish system is also basically the size of this table here. So this becomes portable. They have demonstrated it to be able to set it up in half an hour. So this can be moved around. And so if progress goes that fast, eventually you will have in every lab or even on every tool a MEMS chip, which is a primary standard. So you don't need to send your gauge anymore to NIST or to some other calibration lab for calibration. You always have at your system the exact value as it is determined by the quantum standards. All right, so here our gauges in action in semiconductor industry. And you asked where I come from. I work here in this building. And it's fall, and here you have the mountains, so you can go skiing and hiking and whatnot. So, all right.
A quick question about, so we deal with different gases in our chambers, pumping down from the atmosphere down to very low pressures. I guess capacitance devices are going to be not very sensitive to gas species, I'm supposing, but the other ones, Pirani's, are somewhat sensitive. Mm-hmm. What would be your recommendation for a gauge that would be best from, you know, millibar to 10 millibar to...
Well, depends on your budget. CDGs, I guess, are more the Mercedes version. Pirani is maybe the Volkswagen version.
But the CDGs only go down to...
You can go down to the minus 6 millibar with certain models. So there are now lower full scales. I mean, the lowest... we have is a 10 millitor sensor. It can go to 10 minus 6, but this is not so accurate anymore. I usually say you should use only the upper two decades of your full scale sensor. Okay, good.